Describe what Larry's going on now, isn't it?
Is there a computer address? Is there about 500 years? Those are the only words. It's there's like,
yeah,
that's right. I mean, I think let me put it out there.
Can I go ahead and start?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you all for coming this morning. The last day of the TESOL conference. This is our third hot topic. This one concerning something Carl doesn't always like to talk about. We love to talk about the good parts of technology, but every once in a while technology kind of throws us a curve that we have to deal with. So we noticed this topic being discussed in a lot of the intersection e-lists, so we thought it might be worth addressing some of these issues. And I would also like to mention that this session is being webcast around the world, so we welcome our webcast audience. Okay, we're going to have five presenters. Each presenter is going to have about 10 minutes, and I'm going to be reserving time at the end of our session today for a question and answer period. The first two presenters are going to address more general technology issues like privacy and security. We're going to have a question and answer period after that, and then we'll talk about classroom management issues that can occur with technology. Our first speaker today is Andy Bowman. Andy Bowman is from Wichita State University, and I'm just going to give the floor to him.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning, everybody, and I'm glad you could brave the early cold to get here. I'd like to start everybody out with that URL at the bottom. So if the Wi-Fi is up and going, please copy that address. If not, okay. Well, this is the time to try and get on, because in about an hour it's going to get real slow, or maybe even sooner than that. That's what's been happening. Okay. That's where that URL will take you, and give me a minute to look back. Okay, is it coming up for anybody? All right, great. Okay, student privacy and of course, is an issue that never will end and be resolved, because technology changes so fast. So I'd like everybody to click and take that little quiz and ignore any wrong answers.
It should be okay, right? So,
and let's no more than a minute on each of this to read it through and give a quick answer, and then we're going to take it together and get some feedback going. Why don't you do the first question, and then we'll just break from there. Okay. All right. Let's get an answer for that first question, Aaron. Well, there are no wrong answers, at least not today. Okay, so how many people get a true and a false on that, or on that? Who disagrees with that answer? Okay, well, there are two schools of thought about email. Is it officially issued? Is it okay to use it? I've had people tell me you can't do it, and you have to go through Blackboard or something like that. And what's the feedback on that? Right or wrong? Okay. Probably best not to use email, unless it's going through something like InGrade or Blackboard. Let's go to the next question.
I'm relying on you.
Okay. Is that a violation of student privacy? Well, that's okay. Okay, it really probably is not, because unless you're discussing the student's grade, it's not going to be a problem. If you're just saying, hey, we had it up and it was working, and then leave it at that, it's not a problem. Okay. Now, if you went into any detail, it could become a problem. Probably best to avoid it.
All right, next one.
Okay, question three. Okay. And your answer, Aaron? Right. It should be okay. In fact, there have been court rulings that say it's okay for in-class grading to take place and that students can grade each other and that counts as a grade. Okay. Now, how that information is shared and stored outside of class, that's when it can become a problem. All right. Question four. Now, unless the students have given permission to have their data and their scores given to somebody, then it's best to avoid this, even though the person who is paying for the scholarship and is an authority is demanding it, you would want to avoid this. Question five. The key phrase is legitimate educational interest. Okay. And also in this particular question, it says two teachers have the same student. Well, it could be that at one stage they both had that student. If that second teacher was no longer teaching that same student, it probably wouldn't be a legitimate educational interest because they no longer have a direct connection. Right? Now. Okay. Feedback or disagreement about these answers. Anybody? Which one? Any of them? It's a mix of responses that I've found. So it's not based on one school or one institution. Yes. Mm-hmm. What do I do? Fortunately, it's not my problem. So, it's a very good question, Justin.
So we get that all the time too. Yeah. And before we will accept a student from a sponsor, we require that the sponsor gives us you can call it a power of attorney form, but we have a waiver that allows release of student information, and so the student has signed it. Okay. Otherwise, we want to put that student into our program. Then we're allowed to release information to their sponsor through that. We have a whole, almost all our students respond. We have a whole office that takes care of them. Most of these are not governed by university policy, but by, at least in the United States, federal law. FERPA. So we are not allowed to release grades through FERPA unless we have that release form.
Okay, great. Yeah. If you release to the students, of course, what they do with it then, that's their responsibility.
Right. Under FERPA, one of the issues that I've seen come up at a couple different institutions is even parents who are paying for their child's tuition do not have the right to just see their students' grades or any records about their child without the actual student's permission to do so. So yeah, that does become an issue a lot where like parents are calling records offices and they have to be released. Yeah.
The only exception to that is if the child is a minor. So my daughter is a university student and a high school student together. When I call ASU registrar to try and find out about her financial aid, they say, oh, well, we need a release form. And I say, no, you don't, because she's only 17. But if she was 18, yes, they have to have a release form.
And these are all U.S.
Regulations. So the what did you call it?
PIPEDA.
Yeah. That might have some different rules than
It's typically more restricted. Yeah. Tighter. Probably the best bet is to go through your registrar's office and see what the terms are of that particular student's enrollment if they had a release cleared on that before assuming that, well, this works for one, it works for all. Okay, and back to wrap up the part about working in groups, to working groups, of course, you're going to do that in social media, but releasing information and scores, of course, is probably the best thing to be left alone. At the end of the last question about legitimate educational interest, that's a pretty flexible term. Legitimate and alone is expandable to wherever you want, and interest is very flexible. So that definition is from the Department of Education's official term, and so unless what that person is doing meets that, it's probably best to consider that they don't have a legitimate purpose for that information. And so the question I put up there about the two teachers, that would change depending on what that teacher's role with that student is. And so they wouldn't necessarily be able to ask how a former student of theirs is doing.
Okay. But then if you were to send a student record over email from one teacher to another, that would get you into...
Yes, right, exactly. It goes back to the combination of email and that you don't necessarily have the right to do that. And then to change topics within this, I think because of the growth of technology and how we're using biometrics nowadays, that also becomes a security risk, because when someone does, say, voice recording or they're doing some kind of voice recognition, how that information is stored in a server or where it's stored becomes a security risk to and privacy as well. Test takers that have to use fingerprints or something like that, when that information is stored, what happens to it later on? And then that becomes something that threatens someone's identity. And you can have the risk of information being stored someplace where it shouldn't be. And it's a lot of unknowns at this point. All right. Any suggestions, solutions, how we might get through that? Okay. Yes, I'll open it up. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
So thanks, Andy. FERPA, for anyone who has to deal with privacy issues, is already a pain in the neck, and technology doesn't seem to be making it any easier. Our next speaker is Aaron Schwartz. Aaron's from Ohio University in Athens.
Good morning. So I'm the technology coordinator in my program, and so I'm dealing with computers that are in classrooms, but I also issue computers to faculty members and deal with security on that level. I have a couple of slides prepared, but they're really supposed to be just kind of jumping off points for discussion about this issue. I'm glad Andy talked a little bit about FERPA, because that becomes a big issue, because a lot of times teachers will have access to records, or they will download records onto their computers, and then from there, the teacher who has the record is responsible for the privacy of that record. A couple of things Andy just brought up at the end, when he talked about voice recordings, for example, and other recordings, and even that first question, the question that I got wrong about email, where he suggested that we use a course management system like Blackboard or something like that. Course management systems generally tend to have a form of encryption built into them, or at least they have, I know in the case of Moodle, the data is basically scrambled into a bunch of different folders all over the place. So if you actually went in on the back end and looked at Moodle, you wouldn't be able to find any information that you're looking for. And actually, that's really frustrating when you're trying to fix a problem in the Moodle or something like that. But it is helpful as a way of protecting student data. But one of the things about security is security depends on passwords. And when you think about security, your data is only as safe as the weakest link in the chain of where the data is going. You know, the school's information system, the SIS you have about students, may be very secure. It may have two-factor authentication to allow teachers to log in. It might automatically log you out after 10 minutes to make sure that it's not logged in. But if you've downloaded a student record and it's on your computer and your laptop's not secure, then it could fall into somebody else's hands. So when we look at passwords, I wanted to bring up this. My next slide is it's from the webcomic XKCD. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's kind of a geeky comic that usually features stick figures. But this is it's an oft-cited example here. This is about password strength. And thank you, Andy. If you look at the first one, does anyone use passwords that look kind of like that? You ever seen something like that? Hacker circles, underground circles, that's what they call elite speak, short for elite, where you take a regular word from the dictionary and replace a couple of the letters with numbers that kind of look like those letters, and maybe add a couple of characters at the end because you're required to do so. This is actually quite popular. Lots of people do this. I'd like your opinion. Do you think this is a effective strategy for having a safe password? Looks pretty safe, right? Yeah. And that's the second one. Yeah. So this type of strategy is something that developed over time because, you know, people needed to have these strong passwords. But then this idea of entropy comes in. And entropy is a form of complexity based on when we think about guessing a password. In the old days, it used to be, well, we don't want a person to guess my password. So I don't want to use my dog's name because someone can figure out my dog's name. I don't want to use my mom's maiden name because that's very easy information for someone to find if they're actually directly trying to target me. But if I could pick a random word and make these changes to it, great, and, you know, I've made this change. However, there's a problem with that. Most of the time now, if it's a real hacker, or if it's somebody who is actually trying to steal information, they're not going to be guessing the password with their own brain. They're going to be using a computer program that can guess lots of passwords in a very short amount of time. And part of the problem with this, too, is over time, if you're familiar with Moore's Law, we know that computers get faster and faster and faster, and the speed at which computers get faster also increases every year. So what they're talking about in the second frame there is looking at this first password, it has 28 bits of entropy, meaning that if a computer could make 1,000 guesses a second, it would take about 3 days to guess that password. Okay, that is actually kind of easy for a hacker. You know, they can run their computer, they can have multiple computers aimed at a website, and they can eventually figure out those passwords. Okay, I'm going to jump back too because one of the first types of password attacks that that you might hear about is what they call a dictionary attack, and you can, you know, it's very easy to get a file that has every single word in the English dictionary, and then maybe add a bunch of other words to it too. So if the word is in the dictionary, it can be found very quickly with just by running through the whole dictionary and trying every word as a password. And then those files could easily be modified to include, okay, well, you know, I didn't use O, I used zero. Okay, so they can account for that because they know people use this strategy. It's a very old strategy in terms of the way passwords are used. So, and then we could see this confused stick figure over here. Was it a trombone? No, wait, troubadour? Oh, which one of the ones was a zero? He has some issues with that. Okay, and so it's difficult for a human to remember, but it's easy for a computer to crack. Okay, this next one actually still uses four dictionary words, but it's much longer, and that's where the entropy comes in. Every character that gets added to a password that makes it longer makes it more difficult for a computer to break because it's another character that has to be scanned. It's another character that makes it difficult for the computer to guess. So what this password is correct horse battery staple all together in a string of words, okay? that string of words all together with no spaces probably doesn't exist in any of those password cracking files. Actually, this one probably does because this comic is a couple years old and this is widely known. That's kind of part of the problem too, is if you're attending any type of seminar on security or anything, any example password is not going to be a good password because someone is eventually going to use it. So they take those four random words, but then how is a human going to remember four random words? It's got the 44 bits of entropy. It's much more difficult for a computer to guess, but it can be a lot easier for a human to remember because we can think in images. Okay, a computer can't think in images. A computer thinks in ones and zeros and converts those into other languages. But we can think in an image. So this guy's imagining a situation where he's talking to his horse and there's a battery with a staple in it and the horse says, that's a battery staple, and he says, correct. And then he can remember, correct horse, battery staple. And that's his password. And he can type it rather quickly because we're humans and we can do that. And he'll memorize it. Does anyone think this is a good technique? Do you think this is a technique you would use for a password? Okay. Yeah, and then that's where it comes in. You can go back to the earlier method and pick and choose from those methods. Yeah, you probably need a capital letter somewhere. You might need to replace one of your letters with a number and go back and use the leet speak. You might need an ampersand or an asterisk or something to make your password a little bit more secure. This has been widely cited. A lot of security experts use this slide to describe the security problem. And actually, a lot of security experts have actually come back and said that actually this bottom technique still isn't very good because part of the problem is computers are getting faster and faster. And if this is a widely used technique, of course, it's like an arms race. And so the people that are actually trying to get the data are going to come up with ways to utilize faster computers and figure out how to break this strategy. So I don't know how helpful that is, but basically the idea is passwords are very important and you should change them a lot. Yes? Yes. Exactly. And if you've ever heard of what's called, thank you for bringing that up, John, because actually one of the strategies that hackers actually use to steal data is they use what's called a botnet. And a botnet means that they have, in the old days they called them spiders. I can't remember if that's what they still call them. But basically they have a program that crawls over the network and it crawls over the internet and it finds unsecure computers, which there are lots of all around the world. They find unsecure computers and they take control of them. And they might just, you know, hide somewhere in the computer. The person may not even know they're part of a botnet. And then when they utilize the botnet, they're not using one computer making 1,000 guesses a second. They could be using 1,000 computers making 1,000 guesses a second. And so, yeah, it becomes infinitely more complex as we become infinitely more connected. So one option is, if it's very sensitive data, is keep it off the network. Actually remove yourself from the network, of course, then you lose the convenience of actually having access to the data. You want to go to the next? Okay. So, this brings us to some services that are available nowadays, and I'm not promoting any of these services, but I think it's worth discussing these. There's password management services, and they can be used to generate passwords, store passwords, and encrypt your list of passwords. You probably already have some familiarity with something like this. Like if you use an Apple computer, you have a keychain, and I remember when I started using Apples, I never understood why it kept bugging me about the keychain, and it wasn't until I started managing lots of computers that I realized why that was an important thing. Your keychain on an Apple stores all your computer, all your passwords that you allow it to store on your actual computer. And then you would have like one master password that allows you to see them all. In Windows, I believe it's called something different, but they have the same thing. I think it's Password Manager. Okay, that's very simple. So those exist, and those are actually just part of the operating system itself. And so if you check out your, if depending which platform you're using, you could check your list of passwords, and from that you can delete them if they're not passwords you're using anymore, or you can decide not to use the password manager if you have your passwords memorized. But it's also useful for when you forget your passwords and you can go back and find them. The one that I've been trying out for over a year now is called LastPass, and it's a cloud-based password management tool. And actually, can we bring up the website for it? I didn't put it in the slideshow. LastPass is really, it's a neat idea, but I think there's still some problems with it. But the idea is that LastPass will let you choose one password, and then all of your other passwords are kind of hidden in a vault behind that password. And you don't actually need to remember all of your other passwords because it can generate a password. And there's a couple of different ways to use it, but the way I've been using it is it has a plugin for my browser. It has plugins for a few browsers, but I've been using the Chrome plugin. And every time I go to a new site, if I'm establishing a new account on a new site, it gives me the option to generate a password. And it gives me parameters. Like I can pick the parameters. So like if I want to have upper and lowercase characters in my password, that's a checkbox. If I want to have special characters or numbers, those are checkboxes. And then I set the length of the password. It could be anywhere from 4 characters to 64 characters. And so a 64 character password would have those 64 bits of entropy and be much more difficult for a computer. And there's no way a human would remember it because it is a long random string of characters. Like if you've ever used Google Docs and shared something and you get like the shared link and you get like this long string of U's and X's and W's and V's and you know, there's no way you can like recite it off to somebody to go to it or anything like that. That's how it generates passwords. And then it stores them all in an online vault. And it's encrypted on your end. So, well, at least this is the information they give you, that it's encrypted on your end. So they don't even have access, the employees of this company don't even have access to your passwords. But then you have your one password that you still have to remember. Thank you. So this site's really interesting, and especially if you have lots of different web accounts and and you want them to be secure and you don't want to be using the same password for all of them, it's one that's worth trying. But remember, if somebody gets that one password, then they get all your passwords, and that's like the kind of the ultimate weakness in this. And that's why I recommend. And you want to go back to the slideshow? I will mention these are other ones, and then KeepPass is kind of an interesting one. OnePass and Dashlane are similar to LastPass, but KeepPass, I've talked to a lot of people that prefer KeepPass because it's not online, and it's just on your computer, and it does the same thing. It generates the passwords, but rather than being a browser plugin that's connected to the web, you have that extra sense of security that it's on my device, and if I can keep my device secure, then my passwords are secure. And that brings up this idea of physical access to the devices. And as teachers, you're often using many different computers, and many of these computers are publicly accessible. And so as a technology manager for my program, I basically have set my computers up so the teachers need to log into the classroom computers, and if the classroom computers go unused for longer than, I can't remember what the specific amount of time I said, I think it was 30 minutes. If they go unused for longer than 30 minutes, you need a password to log back in to those computers, because if you walk away, there is access to that data. And have you ever like gone up to a public computer, opened up a browser, and someone's logged into Facebook? Or someone's logged into Gmail? Yes. Yes. And so, you can just flip to the next one, because I'm also, actually, one more. Okay, because I'm running out of time. Yes, fits. So if you look down on my fourth tip here, most browsers have what's called private or incognito mode. Chrome has incognito mode, and Firefox has a private mode. When you use those modes on public computers, those are great because they don't store any local data on the computer. Now, they don't stop Big Brother from watching you or anything like that, but they do prevent someone coming to your computer later and accidentally stumbling on all your information. Because you find that, you know, lots of these devices want to save your passwords, browsers want to save your passwords to make life easy for you. Another thing that I want to mention is that if you like using Google with your students, as many, okay, this is my last point, okay, if you like using Google with your students, as many of my teachers like to do, they like collaborating with Google and everything, there is the Google Apps for Education suite, which you can set up a new account with that that's separate from your personal Google account, and it doesn't get scanned, well, I think it does get scanned, but the data that Google sees with that does not get turned around and used for targeted advertising as the data in your Gmail does. So yeah, that's about all I have to say. Okay.
Okay, that as I mentioned at the beginning, we were going to start discussing security and privacy issues, and I'm willing to take a couple of questions about these issues if anyone has any, or if there are any from the webcast questions. And if not, we'll move on to the classroom oriented technology issues. Does anyone have a question? No? Okay, and Justin, I'm going to ask you, or I'm going to repeat it so the audience can hear through the mic.
One thing that I thought you were going to mention was mobile devices also need to be secured with a PIN code or a password.
Yes.
Because a lot of your data from your Google Drive for apps or, you know, for education or whatever is also available on your mobile device.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people lose their phone, and then whoever finds it has access to all your data.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll repeat that. Justin made a good point, and that is that we need to be careful to protect, password protect mobile devices, especially. In fact, I left mine in the EV Friday.
If you have an iPhone, you can do the the newer iPhones have the biometric where you can actually use your thumbprint as a password.
Yeah.
And you can save multiple thumbprints. Like my wife programmed my thumb into her phone just in case I need to access her phone, but yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks, guys. You're dismissed. I'll bring my next three speakers up. In the next part of our discussion of how to avoid different pitfalls of using technology in the classroom, our first speaker is going to be Justin Schull, who's from Arizona State University.
Thanks, Roger. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the pitfalls of integrating technology into the classroom based on some experiences that I've had and some of the horror stories that I heard. My background is in educational technology. My PhD is in educational technology, and I work a lot with instructional design and curriculum design. And so this is a quote from the co-director of the Educational Technology Center at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and she said that one of the enduring difficulties about technology and education is that a lot of people think about the technology first and the education second. And as an example of that, so I worked in the UAE for 6 years, and I was not in the UAE when this initiative took place, but I know how the UAE works, and I can just imagine that the royal family or the people who are in charge of the three top universities in the country are sitting around and they're thinking, you know, that iPad, that's a cool thing. We ought to use that. All right, buy 14,000 of them, give them to all the students. And so in 2010, that's exactly what they did. They bought 14,000 iPads, distributed them to all the students in the top three universities, and said, have fun. And then all the next 3 years, the teachers and the students were all playing catch up to figure out what to do with it in the classroom. And then the first year, I remember I was at TESOL, and all the people I had worked with were like, oh, it's horrible. The students are playing games in class, and we, you know, nobody's using them. And, you know, and one of my colleagues went from knowing nothing about the iPad to 3 years later becoming a distinguished Apple educator, where, you know, she was designing curriculum to go on the iPad and things like that. So in the end, it worked out, but that 3 years was a really bad experience. Okay. And like, you know, as you can see here, they only had 9 weeks before, so they got them basically in like June, and they were going to use them in fall. They had that much time basically to get ready, to train teachers, to develop materials to use in the classroom. You know, the admins had to figure everything out and all of that kind of thing. So that's a pretty common thing that happens in when people want to use, especially at least in that context where they have lots of money to invest in technology, and maybe they don't really think about the whole education part of it. This is a good example. So Wollongong University also has a branch or whatever you want to call it in Dubai, in UAE. And when they decided they wanted to use iPads, they spent 2 years or 4 semesters researching it and piloting it and finding out what teachers were doing in the classroom and how do the iPads fit in. And, you know, they basically wanted to avoid what they call the technology-driven pedagogy. They didn't want the technology to change the way that they teach. They wanted the technology to become a tool. So that's kind of the model that maybe the rest of the country should have followed. I can't remember when it was. I guess it's a few years ago now. I wrote a chapter on kind of how the process that you might go through to integrate technology into your curriculum. And even if you already have, I mean, it doesn't have to be anything as drastic as the iPad. In our program, for example, we were given a mandate. Every level has to have something technologically based. You know, everybody has to be using some type of technology. We have to be on the cutting edge. And I said, well, does that really make sense? And, you know, and so we started, I mean, it took us a long time. I think it took us 2 years to find something that worked with what we want to do at every level, you know. And there was a lot of piloting. We used over 150 different pieces, different types of technology in our classrooms before we found three that we want to use that fit with our curriculum objectives. And a lot of the piloting was just the teacher finds something that they like, they use it with their students, they tell us how it works, you know, they've used it a couple times. Sometimes if it was something that required, you know, buying seats or something that was more involved, we might pilot it with a class for the session. But we never just implemented something without taking the time to see how it fit in and does it really accomplish our curriculum objectives. So that's the first thing that you have to do, is look at what you want to accomplish educationally and then figure out how the technology will help you do that. And with the language program, another thing that sometimes gets overlooked is how will the technology help students communicate or, you know, to interact in the language? You know, so if there are specific language objectives, if you want the students, for example, to increase the time that they speak in English, then maybe you find a technology that will help you do that. One of our issues was teachers not having enough time to teach pronunciation. You know, because we're an integrated program, so we teach reading, writing in one class, listening, speaking in another class, and we're doing academic preparation, so there's no time to really just focus on pronunciation. And for some students, especially at our lower levels, or at our higher levels too, pronunciation would be a big problem. And so we found, and I'm not like promoting them, so this is not a plug, but we found a website, a service called English Central, that allows them to watch videos, and then they speak. That, you know, they basically recite the same lines that are in the videos, and the computer can go through and pick out differences in their pronunciation between them and the video, and they can go back and listen and do it as many times as they want. And so it's something that we could give them to do outside of class that also helps us accomplish our curricular objectives. But we didn't just say, okay, well, we'll just get them a seat and they'll just do whatever they want. The other thing that we did was, in English Central, you can develop courses. So we developed our own course that we use, and the videos that they're watching are about topics that are in their listening textbook. So now we've integrated that resource, not only for pronunciation, but we've also connected it to things that they're talking about in class. so that there's, it seems to be more integrated and they get more repetition of information and to build up their schema on different topics like energy sources and financial information and different things like that that go with the topics in a listening book. So that's an example of one of the things that we've done. This is a quote that I really like. It's from Reed and McNerney. But basically, they were talking about, especially in EFL context, you want to bring real-world examples into the classroom. So does the technology do that? Are the activities, such as the simulations and web experience, web field trips, used to enable students to understand the richness and variability of real life? So, you know, there are a lot of things that technology can do that will help you expand upon the experiences of your students. And this next quote, okay, this is not by Rita McNerney. I thought I had changed this. This is by a lady named Kundal, and it was in 2008. She wrote a chapter in the same book that I wrote my chapter in. So, but I like how she says, you don't want to just simply digitize things that you're already doing, you know. Use the technology to its full potential. Just because you can take a clothes exercise and put it online doesn't mean that that's always the best thing, and that's not really, it may not be the best use of technology. It, you know, if you're taking a quiz and the student, you're putting it online so it's automatically graded, or you're doing a practice activity so the students can get immediate feedback, that's maybe a better use of the technology. And so, keep those things in mind as you are looking for or developing technology resources. That's all I have, I think. Yeah.
There you are.
So, so thank you. Thanks, Justin. Our next speaker is Claire Siskin. Claire's on the TESOL board for about 9 more hours, I think.
And I'm already off.
Are you already off? And she travels more than John Kerry, doing workshops all around the globe. And she's going to talk to us about using technology in maybe a more low-tech situation.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, that's going to work here. Are you, I probably should do it because I'm going to go really fast. Okay, the handout doesn't have much on it. Also, I noticed that I miscounted some of the things. I don't know how to count there. But anyway, there it does just point to a web page. This is all available on the Electronic Village Wiki. I think the PowerPoint is there, too. I'm going to go really fast. If you want the PowerPoint, send me an email. I'm happy to send it to you. First of all, I want to say I'm sort of getting a reputation for being anti-internet, and I really don't like that at all because I absolutely love the internet. I use all these tools just about every day. I spend way too much time on Twitter. I adore Twitter, okay? And so it's really not true that I don't like the internet. I like the internet quite a bit. However, let's have a reality check here, okay? And that I've been to a lot of different countries, not as many as John Kerry or Deborah Healey, but I've been to a lot of schools, and many of them in the United States and in so-called developed countries, and many times there is no internet access. Okay, I was doing a workshop in Nepal and I had 35 teachers. One of them had access. They all had phones and they had Facebook and so forth, but they didn't have internet access with their students. There was no place where they could take their students and be on the internet. Okay, so people have slow internet. They have unreliable internet. Are you keeping up over there? Yeah. A lot of teachers have internet access outside of school, but not in, and they may have to travel a long way to get to it, but they don't have it in school, or they have very limited access, internet access in school in some cases, okay? Or the internet is restricted. I hear this a lot in my hometown, okay? There's internet, but getting access to it is a bureaucratic hassle. I see John Madden nodding his head here, yeah. What? Okay. My personal favorite, and I'll tell you the anecdote later if you want to hear it, is people who don't have the internet but say they do. That one, that's happened also. Okay. So, and in the field of call right now, there is a lot of emphasis on the internet, on websites and on various social media tools, and that's as it should be. I have no problem with that. However, a lot of English teachers have seemed to have gotten the impression that call is the internet. That's what it is. And the internet is necessary for call. Okay, and people tell me things like this, and this was somebody in the United States. We have a nice computer lab, but we don't use it because it doesn't have internet. I hear stuff like the underlying assumption here seems to be, well, we have to have the internet or we can't use call. Okay, so my message is, even if you don't have internet, you can still use call. There are lots of things you can do, and I'm going to give you, and many of the people here already know this, of course, so maybe, I don't know how appropriate the audience is. Okay, I'm going to talk about two, there are many scenarios, but I'm going to describe the two of the most common ones. One is, the teacher has internet, maybe at home, maybe at a cyber cafe, maybe the school library, the students don't. Okay, the second one is that the students have access to computers, but no internet. Obviously, there are many other scenarios, but these are a couple of really common ones. So for the first scenario, the first strategy is that the teacher can go online and download materials and use them offline. You know, put them onto a USB drive, thumb drive, pen drive, as they call it in India, and use some, you know, play it from your phone, hook your phone up to a speaker or whatever, and use it that way. One website that is very nice for this is the American English website. Everything in there is free. It's downloadable. There are e-books, audio files, videos, songs, games, puzzles, trace effects, all kinds of things. Yes. And one of the really nice things about this website is that you can search by proficiency level, skill area, and audience for the different materials there. Okay, so I'm not going to go into more, since I have very little time, I'm not going to go into that. Okay, another one, have you seen ELT Pics? Really nice. Teachers take pictures and they upload them, and you can download them, and you got all the permission and everything, and it's got various categories. This probably needs to be updated. The last time I looked, there were 827 photos of animals. There are all kinds of really good things there. And it's just a perfect example of worldwide universal sharing by English teachers. Okay, YouTube, you can download the videos from YouTube and use them locally on your local computers. Okay, the second scenario is that the students have access to computers but no internet. Okay, so one strategy there is you can have the students use standalone software, which is software that does not require an internet connection. Microsoft Word, OpenOffice, a word processor. One of the best tools for call that's ever been invented. Okay, using the word processor not just to have the student sitting there typing, but as a tool for in communication. We've been doing this in call for what, 30 years now, at least? A long time. Okay, I'm going to talk about the advantages of using a word processor. One is, if people know how to use anything on a computer, it's probably word processing. So you don't have a big training factor. People already know how to use it. Okay, and it works when the internet is down. You don't have to have the internet to use it. Okay, and it works on really old computers. Okay, so that's a big advantage in many situations. Okay, PowerPoint, okay, or the OpenOffice equivalent of that. Okay, some people seem to think it's wonderful if you have a great projector, as we have here this morning, but you don't need to have a projector to use PowerPoint. You can have students share the files in various ways. One of the easiest is to have students create PowerPoint files and then just stand up and move to a different computer and see what other students have created. You know, you don't have to really have any kind of storage at all. Okay, it's a great way to have students integrate text, pictures, audio, video. If they know how to use Word or word processor, they can use those same skills for PowerPoint because it's copy-paste, same type of thing. Okay, another strategy is to have them use various language learning activities that don't require the internet. CD-ROM, DVD, great games, trace effects, all kinds of other things that don't require use of the internet. Okay, you can create your own activities. Hot potato still works. And people all over the world say, oh, wow, hot potatoes is great. This is good. Okay. On the web page, I've got links to all of this stuff. If you're not familiar with it, you can explore it. Okay. And then there's live code. And I'm sure people will tease me because they know I'm a big fan of live code. Okay. Another strategy which is related to the last one is to have students create their own multimedia. You know, you can get inexpensive headsets with microphones, webcams, and you can have them make multimedia reports, presentations. I like this one. Give them a picture and then have them just record something describing what is in the picture. Okay. You, for audio recording, there are many, many free programs. My favorite one is Audacity, okay, which works on just about every platform. Okay. If you're using PCs, PC Paint is already there, okay? There are similar programs for Mac that you can use, simple programs, okay? If you have webcams, you can have them do video recording. It doesn't have to be used for communication. It's wonderful if you can have them do Skype or something, but if you don't have the internet, you can have them use those webcams to make videos, okay? And use Movie Maker on PC or iMovie on Mac. Okay, another strategy, and I really urge people to look into tablets because with tablets, a lot of the uses of tablets don't require the internet. Tablets are getting cheaper and cheaper all the time, okay, and a lot of tablets have very long battery life, okay, and much more so than laptops. Okay, so I would say keep fighting for the internet, okay, and go to all the sessions and call IS and learn the great ways that people are using the internet so you can go back to your administrators and say, this is why you have to have it, okay, absolutely, but don't let the lack of internet stop you from using call because there's so many great things you can do. Okay, that's it.
Thanks, Claire. And we'll move on to our last presenter for this morning. That's Deborah Healy. Deborah is currently on the board and works at University of Oregon. And she's going to talk about economic issues and equipment differences. Yeah. So thank you, Deborah.
Okay, so far we've been into sweetness and light. When they told me to present on the dark side, I took this seriously. I'm going to start with some sweetness and light. Oops, which way? All right, forward. Oh, okay, see if I can make this work. No. Okay, not a radio mess. Let me just go over here for the moment and see if I can get this to stop doing that. Technology. Oh, goodness. Get it right. Dark side. Yeah.
Mouse isn't moving
well. You got it? Okay.
I'm using the remote, so I don't know. Maybe they unplugged the
remote. There we go. Okay, there we go. All right. There we go. I got it. Okay. All right, on the positive side, a lot more technology out there. You know, there are nearly 7 billion subscriptions with cell phones available worldwide. Not all of those mean 7 billion separate users, but in the developing world, 90% penetration, which means that 90% of people on average across the developing world have mobile phones. My own experience when I've been in various and sundry places, the taxi drivers have mobile phones. It's like, okay, if taxi drivers can do it, everybody just about can do it. So there's a lot of stuff about the digital divide. It's very rosy that smartphones have bridged the digital divide. That access could be the great equalizer for low-income kids. Everyone is on Facebook. And to highlight that, this is an image that showed up in The Independent. This is this came on Mark Zuckerman's Facebook page in September 2013. It shows the links, 1.11 billion friend connections on Facebook, except for John Madden, who is not on Facebook. But okay. MySpace. Okay. But you can see people. Africa has some. You can see a little bit in Gabon. You know, some in South Africa. Not nearly as much in Africa, obviously, as in the rest of the world. And we don't see Australia here, but I'm sure they have Facebook in Australia. So that's the positive side. Data is easy to share. I love Dropbox. I sync across all my devices, you know, your phone, your computer, household devices, all sorts of things you can put together. However, because I'm not a cheerful person, here we have some of the dark side things that I'm going to touch on, which is, you know, if your phone knows where you are, so does everybody else. And privacy schmivacy. The Internet of Things, new digital divide, and cyberbullying and cyberstalking. like I said, they said dark side. So tracking is ubiquitous. This was, you know, on my machine here in Toronto. I did not say where I was. However, because of the IP address of my hotel, Google knows that I'm in Toronto. So, of course, I get ads tailored to me. I wasn't looking for lesson plans, you know, in Ontario, but of course it knows I'm here, so I get that. More shockingly has been when I've been on Yahoo, on Amazon, and I look at something on Amazon, I shift to a completely different website. The ad follows me. Oh, here you can find this on Amazon. I go, whoa, wait a minute. I did not tell this site that I was on Amazon over here. It follows you. And this is, whether it's a mobile phone or a laptop, you are tracked. So this was a judge in the United States whose comment was, privacy is overrated. Security concerns trump privacy. That, you know, you are, you know, yes, you have privacy, but who, privacy schmivacy, who needs it? So it's something that where people get worried about security, we lose privacy, and this is a trade-off that some people are willing to make and some people aren't. This is one of my absolute faves, the Internet of Things. This means this is not only your cell phone knows where you are, your refrigerator is reporting to your cell phone, your things. It's like never miss out on, you know, having enough milk in your refrigerator again. In my community, the local utility company is putting in smart electrical meters, smart meters, so that they can tell when you're using different appliances that are internet connected in the home or Wi-Fi connected. It can helpfully turn off things that you don't need when it thinks you aren't there. It can helpfully turn on things like, you know, the water heater so that they operate when it's cheaper for them to operate. I'm not telling my things what to do. I'm not telling the utility company what to do with my things. They are manipulating the things in my home. I don't really want someone else manipulating data for me. So this is a question of who should or should not be talking to your fridge. I mean, yeah, you could check your fridge on your cell phone and see if you have enough milk, but so can everybody else. If you can do it, everybody can do it. Or someone else can do it. The things that I've been reading about the digital divide are there. There's the rosy, everybody's got a cell phone, life is wonderful. But what's being seen is that people have a digital, there is still a digital device because if you're in many minority communities, especially in the United States, you have a lot of access to mobile phones. However, what are people doing with their phones? They're doing entertainment. They're not doing academic things. If you're at the plenary, access to, you know, literacy and language data is really important on your cell phone. What are you getting? What are you doing? So it may be that more people have cell phones, but people don't have computers and machines that actually do work. So it's a, and then of course the unequal access to digital technology. You can have a smartphone, or you can have a feature phone that has photos, or you can have a really dumb phone. I have a Nokia that I travel with that doesn't even take pictures, but it works. So you have this range of phones, and not everybody has the iPhone 6 or the newest, latest, and greatest. And in a classroom situation, this can be very painful for the students who might say, yes, I have a phone, but who really don't. So more seriously, we have the things related to cyberbullying. And very shockingly, you have the surveys that have been done have not been done in the developing world, but I suspect things are much the same there. In the United States, they did a large-scale behavior survey across students in a wide range of schools, and 15% of them reported being cyberbullied, you know, sent harassing messages. for someone who really lives with their phone, this can be horrible, a truly horrible thing. In a survey in the UK, 7 in 10 had experienced some form of cyber harassment. Absolutely horrible. And while Facebook is the top cyberbullying spot, other places also are where you get cyberbullying, Twitter, Instagram, any place where people can share data freely leaves students vulnerable to bullying. And then to go one step worse, you have cyber stalking. So even though most cyber stalking is occurring on laptops, a lot of it also occurs on mobile devices where you are followed, you're harassed, you're never left alone. If your location is known by your phone, your location can be known by your cyber stalker. So it's sort of a, you know, the very dark, dark side of technology. As we become wonderfully more connected, we become horribly more connected as well when people use the technology for very negative purposes. So, I mean, you use profiles, you use information in a variety of ways. We use it to help us. But as my final comment before we open for questions, let me just leave you with this. Our knowledge of what's being done to us, the knowledge that people have about us, it's all power, and we need to be aware.
Thanks, all three of you panelists. We now have about 10 minutes that we can take some questions. So floor's open for questions. I'm probably going to repeat the questions because so the people in the webcast can hear them. So anyone have questions? Yeah.
Just a comment. We didn't talk about the Apple smartwatch.
This goes off of the Internet of Things. We didn't talk about the smartwatch or the Fitbits, which will track your health information.
Yeah. Comment.
So you want to have a comment? No.
I mean, clearly the HIPAA privacy laws in the United States don't apply when the Internet of Things is concerned. I mean, it goes out, it's in the cloud. If it's in the cloud, it's accessible not only to you. And so again, you know, you need to be aware that as we use our devices to help us track our health, I mean, I use Fitness Pal, something like that, that, you know, where I record my health data. It's a social site. Oops.
We talked about the access to digital devices, but have any studies been done about the amount of data and texting available on people's plans? Because I just recently switched from what I called a dumb phone to a smartphone, and my dumb phone had a pay per text, right? So every time somebody sent me a text, it irritated me because I was paying to read it, even though it was stupid in two words. But now I have unlimited texting, so I'm, you know, sending really short text messages and it doesn't bother me. But I'm wondering if there's been any studies done about the data availability, even texting, with all these devices that people have. You know, they're holding a device that's capable of a lot, but it needs to be connected, and they need to be willing to use that connection. If it costs, you know, if you're paying for a Go plan, you're not willing to do a lot of stuff.
Any thoughts to that?
I mean, I think, I don't know of any specific research on that, but that does speak to that digital divide and that not all access is equal. But it would be good for somebody to really look at that. What do people do with unequal access of that sort?
I don't know about research on that.
Yeah, I don't know about any research that's been done on that issue, but one thing I would point out is that most of that information is available through your carrier's web portal that you might use. And so, again, going back to the passwords, it's like if somebody could get access to that, you know, if you checked your Verizon account from a classroom computer or something like that and left your password saved in the browser, then, yeah, somebody could get access to every call you've made, every text message you've made. Yeah, because that data absolutely is stored, and text messages are in no way a secure form of communication. There have been lots of politicians in America that have gone down as a result of the text messages that they've sent back and forth.
So I had a question. One of the things that I try to be aware of as a teacher is to not to facilitate bullying and stalking. So I thought I might ask the panel what kinds of things that I can do as a teacher. Maybe I can't prevent it in the general, in the world outside my class, but I can certainly avoid facilitating it in my class. So what kinds of things would you do in your own classrooms to, in the way that you use technology, to minimize the students' ability to harass each other?
And we hope that people in the audience can also propose some suggestions. Stalking and harassment have occurred long before we had mobile devices, and I think we do the same things in our classrooms with mobile devices that we used to do. We try to set a respectful tone. We emphasize that students must be respectful to each other. We intervene when we see something happening, but we can't prevent it. We can try to establish a climate where we hope it doesn't occur and say that we will intervene and intervene when we hear about it. Trying to establish a climate where students can tell us when it happens is really important, and whether it's online or face-to-face or physical, I think it's still very important.
About the bullying thing too, there's another resource that we can all use. There's a magazine called Teaching Tolerance that comes out of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it's free, a free resource for educators. They'll send you like materials and lesson plans about avoiding bullying and hate in the classroom. So, just for reference.
So, two comments about that. One is I had a teacher tell me that she had an incident of cyberbullying going on in her class because she had set up an area for the students to just freely comment and communicate with each other, kind of like social networking, on anything. And my thought or my comment to her was, whenever I do an activity that I'm doing where the students are communicating with each other outside of the classroom, there's usually a purpose to it. For example, I do a lot of peer editing, so they'll be posting an essay online, and then they'll be commenting, the students will be commenting and giving correction and feedback. And so anything that's not related to that really doesn't belong in that forum. And so we talk about that. And then and I haven't had any instances of inappropriateness in there because there's a purpose that they're communicating with the purpose. And then the other instance, which was kind of raised, is just awareness. A lot of students may not be aware that what they're doing is bullying, or what they're, you know, it may be acceptable behavior in their culture, or they may have just never been told that it's wrong. And so if we raise awareness and talk a little bit about it and what's appropriate, what's not, I think we've minimized the instance of that.
Thanks. Does anyone else have any contribution? If not, enjoy the remaining hours of the conference. Thank you for coming.
Well, it is in the